The American dream has become a nightmare.
All right, guys, of the back time with the National Intelligence Report here for the 11th day of August in 2023. And we're talking about the socialist Marxist takeover of America. And DW, would you go ahead and continue with your thoughts, sir?
Yeah, well, I mean, we were talking about Dred Scott and where does a down-and-out slave who is, you know, just trying to scratch out a subsistence, managed to come up with the formidable amount of funds that would be required to, and the legal expertise to keep a case in court and appeal for 11 years. How does this happen? So, you know, there's a third party involved. Now, who is that? You won't find that in the if you go to the court case and read the court case of Dred Scott, you won't find the answer to that question. But I think that question is the primary question.
Well, DW, I think there's something else that we need to point out here, too, that is not widely distributed. And that is the fact that a slave state, Missouri, had said that Dred Scott was free. So here we are, the federal, a slave state says Dred Scott is free according to constitutional law. And then 11 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court says, no, you're not. You're still a slave. So do you not think there has to be, you know, something strange going on here? And also something else, and I want to jump and bring Cal back into the conversation. But here's the thing that was happening at the same time, and I think people cannot correlate these, is at the same time, these socialists had put together a great amount of money. These Marxists in the North put together a great amount of money. And did they ever petition the government to abolish slavery? No. They were abolitionists, but they never, ever asked the government to abolish slavery because that would have defeated their purpose. So what they did do was they financed this guy by the name of John Brown. And they sent him into the South to create havoc, the first to Kansas and then to Harper's Ferry. And then when he is caught in Harper's Ferry and convicted and is sentenced to hang for killing, the first person they killed was a black man. Shot him in the back, killed him. That was, you have to understand these things. I think it's imperative that we do. John Brown is sentenced to hang, and the transcendentalist in the North from the pulpit said, John Brown has turned the gallows into the cross. Cal, you want to jump in?
Well, you've asked a question about, you know, Marx and Engels and the money thing. And I think it's important to point out, it's like, okay, you have these two, like the two main guys of this movement of socialism / communism. And then they send their lieutenants, so to speak, like Wiedemeyer and all the others, over into the United States. But Marx and Engels ended up not just in England. They ended up in London.
Yes.
What is it that's in London?
The Bank of England.
So they're basically given sanctuary to ply their craft in London.
Absolutely. And I think we would be remiss, too, gentlemen, if we didn't mention the fact, you know, that John Brown goes into Kansas and he murders people. I mean, just he would go in and get people who were slave owners in the middle of the night and bring them outside. And then he and his cohorts would chop them to death in front of their families. And that was meant to create terror in the South of a slave uprising. That was their entire purpose. The people in the South saw this mess coming. And that is why that Abraham Lincoln did not appear on the ballot in the 1860 election in 10 Southern states. They wouldn't even put the man on there. The people in the South saw this Marxism coming at them wide open with no brakes. And they did whatever they could to stop it in the election. Abraham Lincoln wins an election with less than 40% of the vote and becomes president. You know, the first Republican president, or should we say the first Marxist president? But Cal, continue, please, sir.
Well, before we get this, it was brought up about the scamdemic that recently happened. And back in April 16, 1787, just before the convention, James Madison had written to George Washington his plans at the upcoming convention. And in this letter he writes to him, he tells Washington that the new government he wants to form can't tolerate the sovereignty of the states, but let's keep the states around so they're subordinately useful. And you saw that effect with the scandemic, because the federal government did its push, and it was backed up by this other agency known as the states, which are all sub-corporations of the United States Corporation. Pretty much all of them, you know, you had a little bit of, you know, this faux pushback by DeSantis in Florida, but pretty much all the rest of the states went along with it. And you didn't see nullification from the states. You saw the states playing their part to further the tyranny. And Madison told Washington back in 1788 that that was his intention. And so we get up to the Civil War. We're now reaching up to the Civil War era, and the states that seceded still think they have sovereignty, but they don't. They surrendered their sovereignty. The states that were already states under the Articles surrendered their sovereignty to the federal government. Any state that came in after that never was sovereign. They were a creation of the federal government by the federal government. And so I guess is loss of individual sovereignty a communist plan too? I would think so. Individual, even state sovereignty.
Well, Cal, here's a question, then I want DW to jump in too. If Lincoln, once the war started, and there is a plethora of evidence out there that Lincoln, prior to being inaugurated in March of 1861, Lincoln had already set in plans, if we can look at some of these communiques to the military as the elected president, he was sending out communiques and saying, here, let's provoke the South. Let's provoke. He talked about Pensacola, Florida. Then he talked about, of course, Charleston, South Carolina. Let's use these armies to provoke the South, because it wasn't going to look good if the North initiated the war. They had to have a causus belli. In other words, they had to have a reason to go to war. And so they provoked the South. But Lincoln committed, through his government, committed so many acts of war. And if he was interested in a peaceful settlement, why did he refuse to meet with the committee from the South? Your thoughts on that, Cal, and then we'll jump to DW.
I'm trying to remember who it was, but his advisors, some of them were, you know, don't do this, and others were saying, in fact, I think it was just one. He was saying, do this, kind of like Alexander Hamilton was telling Washington what to do. And I can't remember who it was.
Montgomery Blair.
There it is. Yeah, he had one person in his cabinet telling him to do this. So that makes you wonder, okay, what are the ties of Montgomery Blair to the socialist movement that's now happening in the United States?
Well, it's kind of funny.
Because it's not now happening. Let's say, let's put it this way: the rails were already set. They were set by the Constitution, by the convention. The train was put in motion with the ratification, and the train towards socialism had been chugging down the tracks. And then we get to 1848 and start moving forward. Somebody's just pouring coal to the fire, and this train's accelerating. This is what's happening.
Well, if Lincoln was not a Marxist, why did he put Charles A. Dana, a friend of Karl Marx, a close personal friend of Karl Marx, why did he put Charles A. Dana into his administration? And also, why did he put so many of these military leaders of the communist insurrection in Europe in 1848, why did he put so many of them into the Union Army? And also, why did he accept over 200,000 men from these communist countries or participants in the communist revolution? Why did he put over 200,000 of them in the Union Army to the point so many of them couldn't even speak English, so they had to have commanders like Blinker and Wiedemeyer and Schurz and others who were affirmed communists and members of the communist club?
Well, Mike, how much of a puppet was Lincoln?
No, I think he was just as much a puppet as Washington was.
Okay. So, I mean, we're sitting here saying Lincoln did this, Lincoln did that. He's just a figurehead doing this. He's just a face on the crime. The real crime is going on behind the scenes. He's being controlled. And you see this when you start digging into pretty much every president, you see there's a hidden hand controlling them.
Oh, yes. Sometimes it's in the form of a vice president named Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney or LBJ.
Yes, same thing. DW, your thoughts, buddy?
Well, just to sort of finish out this prelude to the War of Northern Aggression, because of the cultural and media influence, it's really important that in the run-up for the War of Northern Aggression, you have to have the emotional separation, different parties. You have to have this dialectic, the good, the bad, the this, the that, and who adds fire to this is Harriet Beecher Stowe in her book Little Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is a totally fictional creation. And Abraham Lincoln, as much as acknowledges that she had done her great work in writing that novel and putting fuel on the fire, throwing gas on the fire with this book, that didn't resemble any. It was a work of fiction, a novel, and but it served a purpose for the. A large segment of the community that were abolish moralizers, do-gooders. It gave the do-gooders something to scream about. So,
well, DW, may I ask you a question, you and Cal?
Yeah.
All right. Would there have been a civil war if the Supreme Court would have stuck with the Missouri decision and said that Dred Scott was free and slavery was unconstitutional?
Yes, there would have been a civil war, but it would have been they would have had to have found a different casus belli, as you've so accurately used that term. This was a foregone conclusion and an agenda because it's Marxist. And you have to remember, where did we start this conversation an hour ago or so? Is that Frederick Engels and Karl Marx, Charles A. Dana, the 48ers, these are not only ideologues, but they are revolutionaries. And their purpose for being here their purpose for being here is for a revolution. And the Civil War is absolutely misnamed, in my estimation. It's not even remotely accurate in the appropriate use of words. It was a communist revolution. It was the Bolshevik Revolution before the Russian Bolshevik Revolution.
Well, I've got a question for both you and Cal here, and I'll let Cal go first on this one. Cal, we had Marxism established full bore under Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln may have been wavering in his dedication to the cause, and so they killed him. But since Marxism took over the U.S. government under Lincoln in 1860, has it ever gone back? Has it ever left its Marxist principles, Cal?
No, they're still pouring coals onto the fire. This trade's still picking up speed. It's heading for the cliff.
Is there any greater example of the fact that Marxism still controlled America than FDR?
Yeah. Socialism anyway. Yeah, Marxism, socialism, communism.
Your thoughts on that, D.W.? Right.
Well, I mean, this was your question's extremely appropriate, and this was being discussed in the 30s about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's socialist / communist agendas, and a book was written in 1955, two years before I was born. It's written by Dr. Emanuel Josephson, and the name of the book is Roosevelt's Communist Manifesto. And a lot of what Franklin Delano Roosevelt is implementing in his New Deal, New World Order deal, communist revolution deal, is the principles that were written in 1841 by Clinton Roosevelt, almost 100 years earlier. Clinton Roosevelt, and in his book, which I have here, is called, and if any of you out here haven't heard of this gentleman, I use the term very loosely, Clinton Roosevelt, Roosevelt-son, he writes a book called The Science of Government Founded on Natural Law, which has in it a lot of positivism. I'm going to have a shot of liquor to say that one. He is a well-established communist long before Karl Marx, and Karl Marx is reading his writings. Karl Marx is reading the writings of and the philosophies of Kant and Rousseau and Hegel and other French and German radical philosophers to develop his communist manifesto, and what you find is that his communist manifesto, which I have a copy of here, incorporates all the principles of Judaism. Interesting, isn't it? It incorporates all the principles of Judaism, and so what they're it's not real complicated. I call it the American kibbutz, I guess I have the luxury having their own writings and their own books, and the progression of their philosophies, implementation of revolution, government by revolution. And so there's all forms of continuity here. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the ultimate expression of that in 1933 as he takes office. And he has the economic situation at his disposal. The economic situation completely enables him. It's like the Enabling Act for America. We have to use these exceptional, implement these exceptional laws, cultural change, economic change, and governmental change, and he establishes the basis for administrative law and agencies. Huh. Another plank in the Communist Manifesto.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Cal, your thoughts, buddy?
Well, okay, we've jumped from Lincoln to FDR, and I think we're skipping another influence. And he wasn't
we'll
a politician.
Bring it back.
He was a pastor in 1892 named Francis Bellamy, and his contribution to this pouring coal onto the fire, the freight train's fire, is it steaming down the track. And his contribution is what I call the socialist indoctrination prayer, aka the Pledge of Allegiance. And I think that Pledge of Allegiance alone has done so much to get the people here in the United States to accept socialism as a natural way of life for them than pretty much anything else, than any law that's ever done, because they stand up and recite this religiously, and they get mad at you if you don't. If you refuse to participate in their little socialist indoctrination prayer, they get upset at you. Because, you know, that's how liberty works. You get upset at people who don't stand and conform. Am I missing something here?
No, you can have all the liberty you want. Just don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
That's good, Cal. Well, I mean, if we're going to fill in a few more blanks here, we can't forget Teddy Roosevelt in the 1900, around 1900, and he takes over after McKinley gets shot by a communist. Yeah, fancy that, right?
Yeah,
communist. They have a euphemism for that during this period of time. that is a great psyop word too, like conspiracy theorist. And during this period of time in the 1800s and the early 1900s, when these communist Jew hitmen dupes were running around assassinating world leaders in Europe and America, they called them anarchists. Now we
why not?
We wouldn't want to call them communist Jews, but we would call them, let's call them anarchists. Oh, them crazy anarchists. And of course they're lone gunmen. Okay, the lone shooter. Okay, so and so then Teddy Roosevelt takes over, and he's all about taking over massive tracts of land and nationalizing them. So for he's a communist greenie before there's communist greenies, you know.
Yeah, well, D.W. They put icing on that cake. They put icing on that cake at Estes Park, Colorado, 1987, when they took all of the national parks that good old Teddy Roosevelt had created and made them collateral for the national debt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, bankers don't loan you money if bankers don't loan you money if they don't have collateral. You know, international Jew bankers don't loan you money unless they got collateral. I mean, that's just bad business. And so the next guy the big player during this period is Woodrow Wilson. And I'll just skip to the money shot here where he says, the reason after World War, for World War One and America's involvement in it is that we have to make the, now get this, listen to this. This is his quote. This is out of his book, Woodrow Wilson, 1910 to 1917, Woodrow Wilson and the Progressive Era, by Arthur S. Link. And, you know, Woodrow Wilson's quote was, the war, our participation in the war is necessary so that we can make the world, but not America, the world safe for democracy.
Yeah. Yes, and what is democracy?
Socialism.
Two wolves and a chicken deciding what's for dinner. Go ahead,
yeah, D.W. I'll just quote Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes in 1902 states when asked what these isms are, as he says, well, in response to that question, what are all these isms? And Oliver Wendell Holmes, the Supreme Court Justice, says, well, socialism feeds on capitalism and then excretes communism. And I've just never heard a better sentence explaining the method of operation. There's a lot being said right there, because The socialist government needs capitalism to fund its growth and the taxes and the control that comes out of that through capitalism to fund the communist revolutions. This is a part that many Americans don't get, is that they have dug their own graves. And the middleman for that, for their patriotism, was international bankers in the United States government that were facilitating funding and enabling the revolutionaries that didn't produce anything and had no money. So where did they get the money to organize? Just like the 48ers, where did they get the money to buy the papers? Where did they get the money to do that? Well, they got it through capitalism.
Well, D.W., let's not forget, I think we have to throw it in here, let's not forget that Karl Marx said democracy is the first step to communism.
Absolutely. Oh yeah. Well, let's not forget what Rabbi Weiss said in the 40s. He says, well, let me just be perfectly clear and unequivocated. He said, communism is Judaism. Any questions? You know, just comes out and says it.
Absolutely.
And so, of course, I'll stop there. I don't want to get us off track.
Let's get Cal going here. Cal, your thoughts, buddy.
You're not off track. You're saying that stuff, and, they say history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure rhymes, and you're saying that. And the things like, we have to have communism to stop capitalism, and Madison wrote to Jefferson that they had to have a constitution to stop the state from infringing on the people's rights. But we have to have communism to capitalism to fund communism. And listening to the Federalists say we have to have taxes to fund our plans. So
all right,
I'm
music, guys. We'll be back on the other side. We'll be back on the other side. Cal got music going.
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news, real talk, real people. Because you can handle the truth.
I'm so excited to have you as part of the Wild Pastures family, and we look forward to bringing you the pasture-raised meats that you and your family will love. Now, we started Wild Pastures because so many of my clients would tell me they just couldn't find high-quality pasture-raised meats, and even when they did, it was so expensive that they couldn't afford to eat it regularly. Now, I'm not talking about the bottom-of-the-barrel healthy meats that have claims like natural or free-range or even cage-free, terms that were actually created by the industrial food industry to make us feel all warm and fuzzy about buying their low-quality products. I'm talking about truly nourishing pasture-raised meats, the kind that you'll never really find in a grocery store. Our farmers are doing things beyond organic. Our beef is 100% grass-fed and grass-finished and raised on pastures free from chemicals and other pesticides. Our chickens are 100% pasture-raised, where they get their natural diet of grass and forage and insects. We will never settle for free-range, which is actually one of the most deceptive terms in the chicken industry. In fact, less than 0.1% of the chicken consumed in the United States is truly pasture-raised in the way that ours is. And our pork is 100% pasture-raised as well. So if you care about where your food comes from, then you have definitely made it to the right place. As a Wild Pastures member, you'll be supporting the most highly principled farmers in America and getting the most nutrient-dense, nourishing, and sustainable meats in the world. But I'm confident you'll love being part of our mission at Wild Pastures, and you will really love the delicious, nourishing meats that we're going to deliver straight to your door.
Visit republicbroadcasting.org and click the Wild Pastures banner ad. Secure a shipment today. Beef, poultry, and pork. Raised the way nature intended.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It just was doing not good things, and I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Oh, well, welcome back, folks, to the National Intelligence Report, and let's jump back to my buddy Cal Robbins, and let's let him finish his thought, please, before we had the break. Go ahead, Cal.
In my old age, I can't remember what I was thinking 2 minutes ago, Mike. Where were we at?
Well, it's making a point. Yes, you were.
I know I like bacon. I'm not sure of anything, but I know I like bacon.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, if you guys are ready, let's
The thing is you guys put out so many points and my mind goes in so many different directions following, you know, all the rabbit holes you guys keep bringing up. And it's just, oh, it's fun.
By the way, I enjoy these
conversations.
Cal, yeah, as long as we don't turn you into a voter, we're okay.
Oh yeah, you're not gonna.
Cal,
you can't do that. Yes, sir.
I'm not criticizing what you just said, but I just want to clarify something. I want these to be called rabbi holes instead of rabbit holes. They're rabbi holes, that's. I was just listening when I was listening to you talk before the break. I was thinking about you. I'm a little homage to our friend Robert Hudson here. You were making my ears twitch, okay? and I was sitting here and I'm going, okay. So if you've been raised and your parents were raised and your grandfather, during this period of 1930. 1930, that's when most of your grandfathers came, if you're, you know, in our generation, in the 30s. If you were raised and lived through that time, and all your other generations that came after that were raised as socialist capitalists, socialism in a with a capitalist layer over the top of it, then you think that freedom and liberty and socialism are congruent. You don't see the contradiction. You think that that is exceptionalism, indispensability, and you're patriotic towards your socialist capitalism. You think that's what freedom and liberty are. This is how has such a powerful hold on the character of the people in this country. So,
well, DW and Cal, we've got a friend of ours been waiting patiently to have a word into the conversation here, and that is good old Lark from Texas. Lark, how are you, buddy?
Appreciate it. Great conversation. I just thought I'd weigh in just with a few things because I only want to add to what y'all have provided already, which I think is excellent. But, you know, 1841, yeah, Clinton Roosevelt, science of government founded on natural law. You know, what is called natural law to a Kabbalist or a Talmudist is quite a different thing than what others might ascribe as being natural law. And then, of course, in 1841, we had Pierre Joseph Proudhon, the father of anarchism, so-called, the French politician. He wrote something called What is Property? And basically what he said is, well, that's theft. And also in 1841, if you recall, we had Charles Mackey's classic Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. Not to mention, another contemporary of Engels and Marx was this guy named John Goodwin Barmby, who was a leader in the British Chartist movement. And so he's the one that introduced Engels actually to communism in France, but also was the one who coined from the French into the English the word communitarianism. But I just want to share this one observation that I think y'all get a kick out of, and this is from Charles Mackey's 1841 book, The Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. It was in a chapter called The Magnetizers, and at that time, there was a guy in Europe named Anton Mesmer, from which we get the word mesmerize. He's being feted on both sides of the Atlantic. And so in this chapter, there is a footnote, and I'll just share this with you in conclusion, invite your comment. It goes like this. An enthusiastic philosopher, of whose name we are not informed, had constructed a very satisfactory theory on some subject or other, and was not a little proud of it. But the facts, my dear fellow, said his friend, the facts do not agree with your theory. Don't they? Replied the philosopher, shrugging his shoulders. Then, tant pis pour la fée, so much the worse for the facts. I'm done.
Well, thank you, Lark. Comments on that, DW?
Yeah, it's always good to hear from Lark and, you know, his erudite knowledge of this subject matter is to be appreciated. Always, thanks, Lark. I'll just throw in one more that a lot of people may not be aware of that was present in America long before the 48ers and what people thought of as socialism and communism, and that was in Indiana by an English radical named Owens, and he sets up a utopia community in rural Indiana called Owensville, and they're practicing utopic communism. And he's a British radical and an industrialist. He was a capitalist, and he was totally devoted to communism. And I just want to end this by saying, you need, if you're listening to this, you're still with us, you need to connect communism, socialism, corporatism, and capitalism, all those isms. You need to connect them all together directly to the word monopoly. Central control and full dominion of a monopoly. And that's what they are. They're monopolists. So thanks very much, Lark.
Oh, yes, Lark. And before you jump too far, let's not forget with the wonderful Charles A. Dana. Do not forget his experiment. And you made me think of that when you talked about the other communist experience. Let's not forget Charles A. Dana and his failed communist enterprise called the farm. And most people are unaware of that.
Yeah.
But he tried that. Cal, your thoughts on Lark's comments, please, sir?
I enjoyed Lark's comment immensely, especially that last part, you know, where it's Lark says, all the worse for the facts. In other words, I don't care how many facts you have. You're not going to change my mind.
Oh, man, do I remember that one.
Yep.
From a mathematics professor.
But that's pretty much exactly what's going on. That is what the indoctrination has done to the people. It doesn't. For so many, it doesn't matter. We can go through this line by line through the Constitution and show the socialist parts of it, show all of this to the people, and they're still gonna, you know, they're gonna go out, wave their flag, and go vote again, Mike. They're
Absolutely.
Gonna continue down the path. They're gonna think that the train's not running down the track headed for the cliff.
Well, guys. I hope you will not I want your comments on this. I know that you have read it, Cal. I don't think DW has seen it because he's not on Facebook, but I've got to run this out there for all of those wonderful Republicans, if I may, and that's something I posted on Facebook. And so, guys, think of this, please. I said, the study of the details of history is so rewarding. What is that old adage, what goes around comes around? In reality, the Republicans have absolutely nothing to complain about when it comes to the election fraud of 2020 or 2022. In fact, Republicans acted criminally in the 1864 election and may have created the model used later. Payback is a blank. In the 1864 election, Abraham Lincoln and his Republican Party minions were worried about Lincoln's lack of support in New York City, especially considering all of his military actions in that city, in particular the killings and absolute murder during the draft riots. New York Governor Horatio Seymour knew how critical the votes of those in the military could be in what was sure to be a very close election, especially since Lincoln's opponent was the former commander of the Union Army, Democrat George McClellan. In March of 1864, a constitutional amendment was passed by the people, now that's in the state, guys, after being accepted by Governor Seymour, enabling soldiers to vote in the field. In September 1864, as the presidential election approached, Seymour instructed his commanders to give their troops the absentee ballots. But the Republican Secretary of State of New York, Chauncey Depew, refused to distribute the forms to the officers. So Governor Seymour was forced to appoint a committee to make it happen. Then Lincoln's aides seized the agents who were transporting the New York soldiers' ballots. charged them with fraud and either held the ballots until after the election or secretly changed the elections to show a Republican choice as opposed to a Democrat. The agents, Colonel Samuel North, guys, listen to this one, the instigator, Major Levi Cohen, and M.M. Jones were brought before a secret military tribunal, which charged these men with being Confederates and employees of Governor Seymour. And they were charged with being engaged in fraudulent election practices. Thousands of other ballots deposited in the mails were detained in the post offices until after the presidential election. To prevent detection of their crime, the postmarks were altered. In some instances, when soldiers returned home to vote in person, they discovered their ballots had already been sent in as Republican votes. The Albany Argus editorialized, and I quote, "In the history of outrage and crime, which makes up the Lincoln administration, there is no darker deed than this. It reveals the terror and the desperation of the Republican Washington junta," unquote. Do the Republicans have anything to complain about with a dishonest election, D.W.?
No. I was listening to that, and I go, well, I just wonder how far back Dominion voting machines were being used. did they go all the way back to the 1860s? You know, it's I need to just take a minute here to correct myself. I called that town in Indiana, Owensville, and it's actually, the name of it is New Harmony. New Harmony. And if anybody's interested in this, they can just type in Robert Owen, and they can read his Wikipedia page. It actually spells it out. So,
all right, guys. Let's try to get a couple of callers in here if we could, please.
Yeah.
We're rapidly running out of time. Charles in Florida, how are you, sir?
How you doing? Yeah, you forgot Robert Owens is from Rochdale, England. He built new, and I had a cousin that lived in New Harmony, Indiana. She's a cousin of mine. So they still have, I guess they still have practicing socialism there. That he's really considered the father of socialism, Robert Owens, I think. And what about Franklin Roosevelt's ancestor, Clinton Roosevelt, according to Emanuel Josephson, the forerunner of Karl Marx, good close friend of Marx. Marx worked for the Tribune, you know, who's go West young man, I can't think of his name, that started the New York Tribune. What's his name?
Horace Greeley.
Horace Greeley, yeah, Horace Greeley is supposed to have been a member of the Columbians, a branch of the Illuminati in the United States. And, of course, Moses Hess, the father of Zionism and communism, because he converted both Karl Marx and Frederick Engels to communism, which existed before in Germany, had communist societies operating. So Moses Hess, everybody heard of him?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Father of Zionism, father of,
yes,
of converted the to the created modern communism, the Engels and Marx.
Yes, sir.
Any comments?
Well, no, I certainly appreciate your offerings here, Charles, and I hope in the future you'll be able to call in a little earlier. I've got two other callers I want to try to get to before,
sure.
But I appreciate your input, a very, very intelligent input, sir. Thank you very much, and appreciate you, and thank you for tuning in. So now let's jump to Abram in Iowa, the home state of DW. Sir, how are you?
Hey, another day in paradise. It's good to talk to you, gentlemen. All right,
thank
I guess
you
I'll
calling.
Jump right into the question. Yeah, thank you. My question would be, in terms of the Pledge of Allegiance, what is the understanding of the three of you in terms of the ancient roots of that, and maybe the options that we have as Americans that we're never quite told about?
Well, Bellamy said himself about the writing, you know, he had a brother who wrote a book called Looking Backwards, and that would have been a book that eventually America would be entirely socialist, which is today. But Bellamy said that his purpose is to stop any future uprisings like the war between the states.
Oh, and so...
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. If you had more to say, I'm just curious about... There's a difference in allegiance to the United States government, as in the federal government, and allegiance to the United States of America. And so what's interesting is that they are saying this, you know, the pledge is correct. You're pledging to this higher power, you know, the original government of the Constitution, but you are enthralled by the U.S. government. And I was wondering if Daryl had... had any conversations with any of you gentlemen about the specifics of that?
Well, when it was first instituted in the national education system of America, when the young students stood up to pledge allegiance, how did they do so? Are you aware, Abram?
Are you asking if they had their hand up?
Their hand wasn't up.
No.
They were doing, in essence, what later became the Nazi salute.
Right. Well, yep. I didn't mean over your heart.
Except their palm was up instead of down. But Abram, sure. Sir, I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much. Call back in again, please, sir. Would love to talk to you some more, perhaps on a program where we have the whole second hour for callers, which I hope to do soon. I would love it if you would call back, sir. So thank you so very much. And now let's jump to James in Vancouver. James, how are you, sir?
Doing pretty good. In my book here, it says that communist thought even can be traced back to Thomas More in his 1516 book entitled Utopia. So this idea has been around a long time. But if you take Germany, even before Bismarck, it was liberal and it was socialist, because as long as you were a German and you spoke German, didn't matter where you lived in that area, there were benefits for you. And for example, that was what was it made? It was codified by Otto von Bismarck when all of those principalities were united, and he gave them welfare.
Yes.
Back to you.
Oh, well, thank you for that, James. Really appreciate your call as well. I just want to get in a couple
later.
All right, thank you, buddy. Thank you so much. Just want to get in a couple of things. Folks, please go to my Substack, please, gaddy.substack.com, and check out my writings there. And next of all, let me tell you about tomorrow on the Rebel Madman radio program. I'm going to have the Sarge, good old Jim Ram. And I'm sure we'll talk about Robert Hudson a little bit. We would have to. And I really appreciate DW bringing him up. But DW, take a couple of minutes here and or, you know, probably less than that because we need Cal, too. But kind of give us a synopsis of the program today, if you would, please, DW.
Well, I just want to recognize what a great bunch of callers.
They're fantastic, weren't they?
Are these a bunch of sharp guys or what? Everything
oh, absolutely.
You guys said is spot on. And I just want to say wrap it up by saying with a quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. In the past, people came to realize what happened to them one day too late. What we're doing here What we're doing here is we're trying to get you to come to a full appreciation of what's happened before that last day.
One day so before it's too.
My pleasure to. Yeah. My pleasure to be here with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, DW. You're always welcome, buddy. And now, Cal, would you kind of sum us up from your point of view, please, sir?
Well, I got a second. The callers have been great. And just all we're trying to do is point out the reality that everybody's living in, because this train is full steam heading down the tracks and heading for the cliff. It hasn't already gone off the cliff and we're in free fall. I haven't quite figured that part out yet, but other than that, thanks for the opportunity to be on the show with you, Mike. I really appreciated it.
Always my pleasure. Guys, I was just thinking of something. What would it be like if maybe in a future show, if we could get Lark, Charles, Abram, and James to all call in for an hour and we throw this ball back and forth with between us?
I'm up for that.
I think that would be ideal, because these gentlemen had some great input, and I really hated that we had to cramp them up, because I really wanted to ask some questions, bring some more stuff in. Let's see, Charles, Abram, and James, let us know. Let's try to figure out a time, and Lark, of course, let's try to figure out a time where we can take an hour to discuss this issue with you gentlemen throwing in your thoughts, because they are so pertinent. They are so right on spot, and that's what we get with the callers to RBN. That's what happens when you have free speech, folks, and that needs to be supported at all cost. And again, tomorrow.
Mike,
yes, sir. Go ahead.
These are the discussions that need to be had.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is just. Those who have joined us on Jim Rand's Thursday show, these last month, these are tough discussions we've had, but they've been fun and they've been enlightening. And I think everyone who attends that show of Jim Rand's on Thursday that we do is all the better for it.
Well, I would invite both you guys to call in tomorrow when we're talking with Jim, and you guys can interrogate Jim. Well, let's turn it around a little bit.
Okay. We'll gang up on Jim.
Yeah, okay. It's okay. Gang up on the Sarge day.
Yeah.
Okay.
He doesn't know he's getting ambushed unless he's listening.
No, he didn't know. I set him up. Yeah, that's for sure. But guys, Charles, Abram, James, Lark, I am dead serious about what I said. Let's try to figure out a program where we can have you guys call in for the last hour of the program, and we can have one hell of a discussion. I would love it. I hated to see you guys restricted in your time. And the music's coming up, folks. Join us again next week on the National Intelligence Report. Thank you so very much, and support RBN. We've got to have it. Thanks, DW. Thanks, Cal. Good night, everyone. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, guys.
Find your inner rebel at Dixie Republic, the world's largest Confederate store, located in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. The anti-white, anti-Christ, anti-Southern world ends at the asphalt. Welcome to God's country. Log on to DixieRepublic.com to view our Southern merchandise, from flags to t-shirts to artwork. At the store, browse through our extensive collection of belt buckles and have a custom-made leather belt handcrafted in our Johnny Reb's Gun and Leather Shop. That's DixieRepublic.com, where you can meet all of your Southern needs.
Support those that support the network. Support Dixie Republic at DixieRepublic.com. Email ProudSouthern123@gmail.com and let them know that RBN sent you.
The truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today, because you can handle the truth.